This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
I've seen you young, I've seen you old, and I've seen you lost and found.
Welcome to Mountain News and World Report. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer. On this episode, we bring you two stories from the archive. One was produced by Kelly Haywood in 2016 and features the history of Joe Pack's, a Letcher County favorite restaurant in Isom, Kentucky. The other, produced by Beth Bingman, is an exploration into the history of the Fellowship House Day Camp, an integrated summer camp hosted in Knoxville during the 50s and 60s. But first, we bring you this news from the Ohio Valley Resource.
In Appalachian coal country, thousands of miles of streams run bright orange with pollution called acid mine drainage. But if some researchers have their way, that and other coal waste could produce valuable products called rare earth elements. Those elements are essential to many high-tech products. Glynis Board reports.
Paul Zemkevich is standing in front of a silo full of crushed limestone that slowly gets flushed into a stream pouring out of an old coal mine here. It's a state-of-the-art, state-operated facility that treats acid mine drainage. If it weren't here, the stream would run rusty red, killing ecosystems in its path.
Okay, so we're at the Omega Mine, and the Omega Mine is about 4.5 miles south of Morgantown, West Virginia. And it's an area that's been heavily mined for coal since the Civil War.
This year, Zemkevich, the director of the West Virginia Water Research Institute at West Virginia University, was awarded $2.6 million federal dollars plus funds from the private sector. His research aims to locate, isolate, and commercialize select hard-to-gather elements of the periodic table, elements that are critical to the technology age we live in. Some of those elements can be found in acid mine drainage.
I finished up some calculations that the acid mine drainage production in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Eastern Ohio can supply anywhere between, and this is in terms of rare earth, somewhere between 800 tons per year to maybe 2,200 tons per year. 800 tons a year is basically what the military needs for defense purposes and contractors.
Zemkevich and a handful of other scientists in and around the Ohio Valley make up the majority of the American team dedicated to cracking the rare earth element puzzle. That is, the team that's on the hunt for rare earth elements and how to build an industry around them. The Americans are the underdogs. Right now, China is the team to beat, where 95% of the rare earths used in phones, electric cars, and smart bombs are all sourced.
In 2011, the prices of rare earth elements spiked, in part because of a supply problem from China. And so that instilled an interest in researching rare earth, other sources of rare earth elements throughout the world, but also in the United States.
Tom Tarka is the technical project lead for rare earth elements at the National Energy and Technology Laboratory in West Virginia, or NETL. He explains about 140,000 tons of rare earth elements are produced globally each year into products on the market. There's no commercially available alternative for sourcing rare earths outside of China. And since the U.S. doesn't want to have to rely on any single other nation to provide important components critical to national security, government funds are funneling into research at NETL in Morgantown, a national lab that focuses largely on coal and fossil fuel research. Mary Ann Alvin is the head of the Rare Earths Division there.
Right now what we have is actively 15 programs, 15 projects that are investigating not only separations, investigating where we can find our best reserves, and how can we take this forward.
Rare earth mines have tried and failed in the U.S. already. They just weren't profitable on their own. The hope now is that rare earth mining can be economically viable if it piggybacks on other mining operations, like coal. Tom Tarka from NETL explains that researchers have already begun to identify rare earth elements in and around coal seams, as well as those within waste products associated with mining and burning coal.
In Appalachian coals, especially Southern West Virginia and Central App, we're seeing more heavy rare earth elements. And that's good because these heavy rare earth elements, they're rarer and they have an increased value as a result.
The thing is, rare earths are not rare so much as rarely concentrated and hard to extract. It usually takes acids and harsh chemical processes, which create the stuff of environmental nightmares. But as Paul Zimkevich at the Water Research Institute knows well, West Virginia is already coping with environmental nightmares.
Before the Clean Water Act, the Monongahela River at Morgantown was orange, and it had a pH of about 4.2. It was absolutely dead. There was hardly anything alive in it. The only difference between then and now is the amount of treatment that water gets before it winds up in the river. In the Mon River Basin, I think something like a third of all the acid mine drainage is actually being treated in industrial-sized operations.
So acids are literally seeping from coal mines everywhere throughout Appalachia and apparently leaching rare earth elements in the process.
It turns out that the more acid seams give us the best results because it has the most pyrite. Pyrite in turn generates the acid that leaches the rare earths out of the rock.
Zimkevich's research is not only identifying which elements exist in acid mine drainage, or AMD, and the sludge left from treatment of polluted water, but also how to process the elements and get them into a marketable form.
Rather than sludge disposal being a liability, if you could actually make some money on it, and it's probably not going to pay for all of the costs of AMD treatment, but if it knocks down the cost by 20, 30, 40%, that's a very, very significant incentive to continue treating acid mine drainage.
And Zimkevich is just one researcher. Others in Kentucky and Pennsylvania are studying lots of other coal waste products like coal ash. There are literally mountains of discarded coal ash throughout the region. Coal scientists estimate that with continued research and the right economic pressure, a rare earth industry in the Ohio Valley could exist in 10 to 20 years. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown, West Virginia.
Next up, a story about Jopax. Jopax is a drive-in in Isom, Kentucky, famous for delicious fried chicken. Kelly Haywood produced the following story about the history of the restaurant in 2016.
Nobody that I've ran into calls it Joe's Drive-In Chicken.
No.
It's Jopax.
It's always been Jopax.
Jopax.
Mm-hmm. My dad was a big, strong man. You know, he was a policeman when I was young. I thought there was nobody in the world as big and as strong as my dad. He was a man of few words. I guess he was a thinker. He believed in taking care of family. He didn't take a lot, though. I guess from being years as a policeman, he didn't take much. So when salesmen or somebody come by or somebody tried to take him, he just wouldn't have it. You know, yeah. He just put him on the road. But he was a good businessman. I guess being a policeman, after a while, he just sort of got tired of seeing all that, you know, yeah. That you have to go through every day. And decided he would try to strike out on his own and have a business. Then when I was 12 years old, my dad built a little restaurant there where Long John Silver's is right now and sold hamburgers and hot dogs and just were busy as we could be. At that time, there wasn't restaurants on every corner. You know, there wasn't any fast food popular restaurants. There was two little custard stands up in town. And I started working when I was 12, every evening after school and weekends. I was there till closing time, and closing time to my dad was when nobody else wanted to eat. As long as there was customers, you waited on them. You fixed them whatever they wanted, and you just went home whenever they got tired of eating. For the first few years, we just sold hamburgers, hot dogs, and whatever. But then there was a man came by in a little station wagon. He was an older gentleman. He came up to the window and asked to talk to the manager. My dad was there, and he said, "I'd like to bring a special chicken pot I have in. I'll buy the chicken, I'll buy everything you need, we'll cook it and we'll give it away." My dad took that chance. So the man went to the grocery store that was near and bought some chicken, came in, brought his pot in, his oils in that he put in it, got some chicken, cut that chicken up, and fried chicken all day long. We gave away chicken all day. And that sold my dad on that. He had special breading. It's still the breading we have today. But the man came by regularly after that, and he sold my dad one pot then, and he brought back another, and there at that restaurant, we always had two going all the time, and we had a spare. We, as well as the public, just fell in love with the chicken, yeah. And so from then on, chicken was the hit. You know, we still had burgers, fries, hot dogs, but that's when Joe's Chicken really started. And we've hired and worked lots of the young people in the area. The lady that finally bought the restaurant here, Lucy, she started up there when she was younger. I'd heard him say one time, "You have to have a business where people are going to always be there. Either they're going to eat, you know, you've got to eat somewhere. You know, there's always going to be people that are hungry. So I guess that was his idea.
So it's more a business decision than a food decision.
I think so, yeah. In the beginning. Just, you know, you're going to have business because there wasn't any restaurants. And we never had a eat-in restaurant. It was always carry-out up there. I don't even know if you had a place to sit outside up there. You just had to eat in your car. Well, he ran the restaurant in Wattsburg, and then Long John Silver's came by and decided they'd love to have that spot for their restaurant. But while he was still running the restaurant there before Long John Silver's came, he built this restaurant. He had an older trailer, and he built the front part on a frame, made it all there, and pulled it all down here, put it together here, made a mobile restaurant, actually. It could be moved again if it ever had to be, but I hope it never has to be because it's been there too long. They weren't closed any days then, and it was just 7 days a week, every day. And then Lucy became interested. She'd worked for him some. A few years later, he just sold it to her because he was getting older and a little tired, you know, and he'd worked a long time, and so he decided to sell it to her. And she was very successful with the business. Always did a good job, kept up the reputation of Joe's Chicken, just like it never missed a beat. You know, I think she just did a great job. Lucy decided she would sell it. And my daughter at the time, she decided she'd love to get that back, to get the restaurant back in the family. And it was a long, hard process just trying to think, you know, am I going to quit work? Can we make it? But, you know, it's a good business. And so they made an agreement, worked out very well, and my daughter's very happy being here, and she just, I think she feels blessed to have it back in the family. It's sort of come full circle. Wow. Fish sandwiches, coleslaw,
gravy, mashed potatoes,
green beans, baked beans. Yeah. We have just about everything that any other drive-in would have, but, you know, we also have chicken. Donna Mason, I'm the owner of Joe Pack's Drive-In, Isom, Kentucky. Gave up nursing and come back to the restaurant. Actually, my earliest memories are here. And really, there wasn't much as a child to do around the restaurant, just hang out and probably get in everybody's way, I'm guessing.
So, I understand that at one point he opened a second location in Isom.
Right.
And then he sold the property and location in Whitesburg.
Mm-hmm.
Then he sold the Isom store to another lady.
Right.
Who actually ran it longer than Joe Pack did.
Exactly.
Tell me about what you know about that.
Her name is Lucy Ayers. She ran the restaurant for 30 plus years. And if not for her, I don't think the restaurant would still be thriving and still here as a small business. It's tough, but she kept the reputation up, the quality and the service. Because of her, I think it's still going strong. She took good care of it. She kept true to the recipes. Nothing changed from when he started it. Everything's still the same to this day. The secret's still the secret.
Yeah.
When I got the restaurant back in 2014, I felt like I was back home. It felt right. The first year was rough just because I'd never been a business owner. I'd been a nurse. Stepped out of my comfort zone quite a bit, but I've enjoyed it thoroughly.
Now, what do you think the secret is to the longevity of Joe's?
I think the quality of the food, it's good. I mean, it's good food, and it's a local small business. And I think now, with the economy being so bad, people are trying to support those small businesses even more than years ago. And I know I am, too. But I think they just know that when they get something, it's going to be good. And if not, we'll make it better. If they have a complaint, we'll fix it. Our chicken's always fresh. It's never frozen. So we get the chicken delivered twice a week. That's where all the secrets start, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give much of that away. Our chicken's fried all day long. People actually get kind of upset towards closing time at night because we're not a chain restaurant. We're a small business. So we kind of slow down on frying the chicken close to closing time. So if you pull in at 8:30, you might not get a piece of chicken. You know, we don't want to get stuck with a big pan of chicken. That's money lost. You have to come early and get the chicken.
Yeah.
It's a Letcher County tradition. It's a spot that people are familiar with. Even when they move away or they come here for a reunion or come back for a vacation or just a weekend, that's a spot they want to come to, is Joe Pack's.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard a lot of people say every trip we make to Whitesburg, we stop and get chicken. They want to keep that memory alive. I try to support the community as much as I can. I try not to turn anybody down far as a fundraiser or a donation or anything the schools are trying to do. That's important to me. I would say, depending on the type of year, anywhere from 10 to 12 families this restaurant supports locally. That's 10 or 12 families that have jobs here and putting into the economy. I think I have two that's been here 12 plus years. One is Betty Thomas. She's our chicken fryer. She's been here 12 plus years. And Martha Faye Collins, she's been here 12 plus years. She was a window worker for many of those years when Lucy was here. And then she's moved back to the kitchen, and now she's the day shift manager.
Tell me what a chicken fryer does.
They fry chicken all day long.
You got to love to fry chicken for 12 years.
Yeah, right? And especially on these holidays, it's a lot of chicken. I can't imagine living anywhere else. I mean, I love to travel. I love to visit other places, but these mountains are home. We're just good mountain people. We do well. It's went down, of course. All the coal jobs are gone, just about. It's really hurt the economy. Those were good paying jobs. There's hardly any mines left. So those families are having to seek other employment or moving away. My husband and I, we've had coal trucks all these years. There's no coal left to haul. He's got some trucks over the road hauling flatbed stuff. That hits home to me. I try to live every day as a happy day.
Yeah. Can you remember that first day?
I was scared to death. I did not have a clue what I was stepping into.
Oh, yeah.
No. And if it wasn't for these girls here helping me, and they still help me, and I still ask them a lot of things, and I respect their knowledge and of the restaurant, and they've got me through these 2 years.
Yeah.
A lot of the girls here, they care just as much about the restaurant as my family does, so they take care of this place.
Last on this week's program, we bring you another story from our archive. Beth Bingman produced this piece about the Fellowship House Day Camp. The Fellowship Camp was an integrated summer camp in Knoxville during the 50s and 60s. Beth attended the camp as a child and brings us the following story.
Oh, grandmother was involved in anything that involved civil rights. I mean, grandpapa too, but grandmother was way more active. And obviously somebody mentioned that, and it was about integration, and of course she's going to be in favor of that. And as I said, the bus came by and picked us up.
The bus that picked up young Nikki Giovanni took her to Fellowship House Day Camp, a summer program in Knoxville, Tennessee that began in 1950 and continued until 1972. The camp was initiated by a small group of Knoxville women, including Giovanni's grandmother, who wanted to create an atmosphere for children in which they may develop understanding and appreciation of their neighbors here in the community and in the whole great wide world. I went to the day camp, too. I do remember that the camp was racially integrated. It seemed natural enough as a child, but looking back on it, I realized that this was very unusual for that time and place. Over the past couple of years, I've been seeking out people who might remember Fellowship House Day Camp. One of these was Gid Fryer, camp director in 1951.
So it was actually a knockoff of the Vacation Bible School.
Uh-huh,
So while the Baptists were having Vacation Bible Schools, Fellowship House was having the equivalent without the Bible.
My memory must be of one of the first ones, because I remember a road going up to it that was dirt, that was clay. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was very woodsy around, mm-hmm. and my impression it was on that side of town on the outskirts, and I don't know what the name of it was, but I just really remember a lot of children and arts and crafts.
Oh, our daily routine would have been assembly, devotion, and then we had classes. We had teachers, and then they had crafts, and then they had action sports. Mm. We did camping trips, and the camping was just like being in a Boy Scout troop. You know, we weren't learning how to make knots and stuff like that, but we were learning how to build campfires, how to cook over the fire, that type of thing. How to do a backpack and a sleeping bag, the things that you use for camping.
I remember the counselors. We did a lot of singing. We sang a lot of camp songs.
Silly songs.
Silly songs and rounds and John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt.
Oh, yes.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Those kind of things.
Of course, they swam. They loved to swim because they many of them didn't have that opportunity at home and didn't get around to the parks. And we had, and because I did the music part in the camping where I worked, we had a big emphasis on singing. So we did lots of camp songs and what have you. And then we did arts and crafts, you know, craft work, lanyards. And then nature. We had a big emphasis on nature because we were at Caulkowan Park. We were in the woods,
yeah,
you know.
Okay.
So we did a big part of the camp day on nature.
We heard from camp counselor Sherby Jones, former campers David Turk and Mary Hook, and from Lois White, camp director from 1968 to 1972.
We didn't have problems. We were children. We had fun. If it was a social experiment, it was in their minds. But whatever it was successful because the camp grew.
The staff was aware that they were undertaking something that might have been a bit risky. Many of the organizers were members of the Unitarian Church in Knoxville, and this congregation had received threats when they accepted their first black member. Dick Henry was the Unitarian minister when the camp was started.
They began out of a desire to have really important, significant program for the kids. And they were not going to have any questions asked about race. All comers would be welcome. And they were eager to have a cross-racial group of folks intentionally integrated. And there was a little hush-hushness about it as it got going. I remember thinking, well, we're off here in the mountains and they won't find us.
Ruth Martin, camp director in 1957 and 1958, described an incident on the way to taking campers to the Smokies.
We stopped to buy gas. And of course, you know, when you go get gas, you also do these other things. And so the girls immediately left the car to go to the bathroom. So they were gone from the car when the attendant got back. And he said, well, where are the girls? And I said, well, they've gone off to the bathroom. Oh, you know, that was just to him a terrifying idea that they would go to the white bathroom. Mm-hmm. So he got really livid and said, you know, when did they leave and when will they be back? And I remember just dragging my feet about it. We just loitered along, and pretty soon I saw the girls were coming slowly back from the bathroom, and that all was taken care of. We didn't think of ourselves as very, very brave, just a little maybe, because it just wasn't the way you did things back then. We were not flaming liberals at all. We would go along with the quiet
smoldering
way of getting things accomplished.
Well, what I remember, it was a fun camp to go through and it was interracial. And as I recall, it's probably my first experience in any kind of interracial situation like that. And I think, as I say, the interracial part of it, that was a very progressive thing for the time, because, you know, being in a segregated society in the mid-50s, there wasn't hardly any interaction for children or adults.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of like, I think, an experiment to see how it would work, and, you know, didn't have any problems.
Your level of understanding is better. You grow up with more. You're more open
It wasn't like the Civil Rights March on Washington. It was not that. Excuse me, it wasn't. It wasn't politically charged or anything like that. For the kids, it was a good summer, a good multicultural experience. Mm-hmm. I have to say that.
For the adults, the organization of the camp and the subsequent organization of Fellowship House led to other activities working for racial justice in Knoxville.
Well, yeah, that was, Fellowship House fostered opportunities for interaction between blacks and whites. So it was an anti-segregation group, and the opportunities were not extensive in Knoxville at that time for interracial fellowship.
Fellowship House members, many of whom were camp parents or staff, were involved in efforts to integrate the University of Tennessee, Knoxville healthcare facilities, and the Knoxville City Schools. In 1960, students from historically black Knoxville College, the site of the day camp beginning in 1957, began to sit in at downtown Knoxville lunch counters. Fellowship House members joined them, as did Harry Wiersema, a former camper and junior counselor.
My parents sent me to fellowship camp. They sent me to a church that was integrated. I had black friends in Sunday school. And then, when I come back from working in steel mill on engineering co-op program, my mother and my father, now my father's real energetic. My mother was always, always had a headache and always sickly, but she was down there at noon getting bug spray sprayed in her face. From the people at the lunch counter. And my dad was doing all that, risking his job. And I didn't go through any training. I just showed up. I just found out where the sit-ins were, and I showed up. And because I'd absorbed all that.
I think it did have impact on the town, because even though it wasn't, I don't think it was something just highly publicized, it wasn't a secret either. And I think that it helped people to know that, well, the races can do something together, especially young people and children. So I think that had a good historical impact, in my opinion, that these walls of separation are coming down and you see an experiment going forward. So I think it had a ripple effect.
Former camper Daniel Brown is in a position to know about the ripple effect the day camp may have had. He's on the Knoxville City Council and served as Knoxville's first African-American mayor. Nikki Giovanni put the importance of remembering and telling these stories in a different way.
And, I think everybody appreciates the fact that, and she was not alone, all of those women. And that's what I'm saying. I think that working with the 70-year-olds is important, because we're letting a lot of little stories that nobody thinks amount to much, but when you start to put them all together, you see how cities were changed because of women like my grandmother,
That was writer Nikki Giovanni reflecting on the Knoxville Fellowship House Day Camp. This radio feature was produced with support from the Appalachian Sound Archives Fellowship Project at Berea College. For WMMT, I am Beth Bingman.
And the news is no disgrace. You see, we're not so different after all.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News and World Report. Music on this episode from the June Apple recording of Cy Khan playing a song called New Year's Eve. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, visit our website at www.wmmt.org. I've been your host, Rachel Geringer, and from all of us at WMMT, Happy New Year.
And children in the bed to keep you warm. May the people there accept you for what you really are, and help you find some shelter in the storm. And morning rain to ease the pain that comes with being free. May the new year bring you freedom peacefully.
This This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.